Welcome. Thank you for joining us on this Tuesday evening, even though at least for those of you who are in DC, it is so beautiful outside. My name is Ben Field. I'm a member of the Young Lawyers Board here in the District of Columbia chapter. And it's my pleasure to introduce our speakers and then to hand it over to our moderator for the rest of the event. So I will do that quickly in alphabetical order. Starting off is Josh Hammer, who among other things is opinion editor of Newsweek, a research fellow with the Edmund Burke Foundation, and counsel and policy advisor for the Internet Accountability Project. He's also a syndicated columnist who has published widely, including in the Los Angeles Times and New York Post. He clerked for Judge Jim Ho of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit and graduated from the University of Chicago Law School. Next up is Jennifer Huddleston, who is Director of Technology and Innovation Policy at the American Action Forum, where her research focuses on the intersection of emerging technology and law. Previously, she was a research fellow at the Mercatus Center. Her writing and commentary have appeared in outlets such as USA Today and the Chicago Tribune, CNBC and Fox Business, and in testimony before Congress and state legislatures. She graduated from the University of Alabama Law School. And finally, our moderator is Tom Johnson, who most recently was the general counsel of the Federal Communications Commission from 2017 until just this last January. Before that, he served as Deputy Solicitor General of West Virginia and practiced law at Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher. He clerked for Judge Jerry Smith of the Fifth Circuit and graduated from Harvard Law School. And now I will step out of the way and hand it over to Tom to actually let the experts talk.
Well, thanks so much, Ben and Jennifer and Josh. Thanks for making time for this today. As Ben mentioned, I was the former general counsel of the FCC, and in that capacity, I became familiar with Section 230 as my agency grappled with what role, if any, the FCC should play in interpreting this very unique provision of the Communications Act. So I'm honored to have the opportunity to learn more today from our expert panelists on the future of Section 230. So as some of you listening here today may know, Section 230 was adopted in 1996 as part of the Communications Decency Act, which itself was merely one part of a larger overhaul of the 1934 Communications Act to update it for the then nascent internet age. In adopting Section 230, Congress was responding to recent judicial decisions that grappled with how common law rules governing when traditional distributors like newsstands and bookstores could be held liable for the speech of third parties, how those applied to emerging online services like the bulletin boards or chat rooms hosted by CompuServe, Prodigy, or AOL. That early case law suggested that if a website made any effort to edit or delete content to create a family-friendly online environment, it could be held liable as a publisher for any defamatory, libelous, or otherwise unlawful content that appeared on its site, even if they were unaware of the content of the user's posts. This created what has become known as the moderator's dilemma. Websites could refrain from moderating any online content to receive a higher level of protection from civil suit, but potentially allow obscene or harassing content to proliferate on its site, or else they could attempt to police what users post through community guidelines or other measures, but open themselves up to potentially significant liability. The solution Congress provided in Section 230 was to provide that, quote, no provider or user of an interactive computer service, a statutory term that's broad enough to encompass websites such as today's modern social media companies, shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider, in other words, by the users of the service. Congress's expectation in adopting this was at least twofold. First, Congress hoped that this federal protection from civil suit would incentivize websites to create a family-friendly online environment that would protect children, hence the section's Good Samaritan title, without fear of liability for user content. Indeed, this was only one of several child protection provisions adopted in the Communications Decency Act, although others were struck down as unconstitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court. Second, Congress hoped that Section 230 immunity would promote the growth of the fledgling internet economy by protecting it in part from federal and state regulation. Fast forward 25 years, and needless to say, the internet ecosystem looks a lot different than it did in 1996. Social media sites featuring millions or even billions of users and posts have replaced the relatively small chat rooms of the mid-90s. Congress, meanwhile, has not made any major amendments to the Communications Act since 1996. And Section 230 is facing fire on multiple fronts. Some critics believe that today's social media websites are abusing an immunity designed to encourage removal of obscene content to engage instead in politically motivated moderation of conservative viewpoints or other unpopular points of view. Others, on the other hand, believe that websites do not enough content moderation to check the spread of misinformation or other dangerous activities online. Section 230's defenders, meanwhile, maintain that it has played a vital role in promoting free online speech, creating jobs, and ensuring American leadership in the internet economy. So to help us make sense of this debate, I'd like to invite our panelists to present their own views on Section 230, whether it has been a smashing success, an unmitigated disaster, or something in between. So I flipped a coin and it's come up, Josh. So why don't you get us started?
So thank you so much, Tom. Really delighted to be here. Tom obviously has substantial expertise in this topic. Rarely do we kind of get a Feral Society event where a moderator is so well versed in the literature. So this is a pretty rare and special occasion, I think, from that perspective alone. So really happy to be doing this. I see some friendly names in our audience. So hello, friends. You know who you are. Look, this is an incredibly topical debate, and I thought what I would first do in my introductory remarks is kind of just take kind of a broader view of my approach to kind of the tech issue in general, frankly. I thought that might be kind of thematically or theoretically helpful before trying to get into kind of the weeds and like statutory citations and things like that nature. So look, our timing of this is funny. I did a podcast on Section 230 literally this morning, so I kind of got my brain running on that. And the podcast interviewer basically said to me, he basically said, to what extent do your arguments hinge on the proposition that the proverbial kind of town square, right, the Thomas Paine pamphleteering with common sense in the Philadelphia Commons in 1776, to what extent do your arguments kind of hinge on the notion that that town square has now been privatized by largely unaccountable, in this case, legally immunized Silicon Valley oligarchs? I'm not sure how much my arguments and my views on this quote unquote hinge on this, but they are very much directly affected to it. And, you know, this is not a panel about antitrust per se, although it's kind of hard to separate a lot of these kind of legal remedies and possible solutions from one another. But just talking about like sheer market share data, you know, Google's market share in terms of a basic online search is north of 90%, somewhere between, I think it's like 77 to 79% of U.S. adults. The last time I saw data on this, have a Facebook account. Amazon, of course, you know, we recently saw Amazon in the news with respect to my friend Ryan Anderson and his book on the transgender issue. Not a particularly provocative or inflammatory book. Ryan is very much a scholar and writes like a scholar. And when Amazon kind of nuked his book, you know, saw people talking about how Amazon has, I think, an 83% market share in digital book sales. So to a large extent, it seems to me fairly intuitive and obvious, actually, that we have actually privatized what the old public town square was. And, you know, I think Tom kind of laid out the history here very helpfully. And, you know, as this is a Federal Society event, as conservatives, libertarians, right of center folks, whatever we self-identify as, you know, we're trained to think about originalism, textualism, trying to kind of get into the frame of mind, so to speak, of the time and place where illegal statute or constitutional provision was enacted. So the context for 1996, which of course is when Section 230 came to law, is deeply important here. As Tom kind of already teased, the internet was very much in its infancy. I think 20 million Americans had access to internet at that time. That number today is over 310 million, if I'm not mistaken. 85% roughly of American adults have internet access at this current time. And you know, at the time that Section 230 was to play, and you know, just make sure we're all on the same page here. Actually, I think I probably should just read the actual text of when people talk about Section 230, it's 47 U.S. Code Section 230. They're mostly talking about, as far as I'm aware, they're mostly talking about statutory subsection C1, which is the so-called Good Samaritan provision. That's probably what we're going to talk about most tonight, I would imagine. So just so we're all on the same page here, let me just actually read what that provision says. It says, quote, "No provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider." Broken down to so many words, you know, if you operate kind of a an online message board, Reddit, or whatever kind of the functional equivalent of Reddit or some website like that was back in 96, you know, back in the days of kind of dial-up AOL, you've got mail internet, you cannot be held legally liable for the third-party comments that were posted to that forum. It seems to me at a time back in the 1990s, that we're kind of challenging the mentality, a time when Democrats, Republicans alike viewed tech as kind of the great next frontier, the great kind of vanguard of American capitalism. Politicians, both parties were trying to kind of just outdo one another in bestowing political kind of incentives upon Silicon Valley. At that time, place, and manner, it seems like it would have made a great deal of sense. You know, I was only 7 years old. I wasn't old enough to formulate an opinion at the time, obviously. But given kind of the data and how few internet or how few Americans had internet access and so forth, it makes a great deal of sense to me that Americans at the time would have kind of gone out of their way to bestow immunity for things like this to basically try and get this industry kickstarted. But the situation obviously has changed 25 years later now. You know, there's any number of things that we can possibly point to as to why the situation has changed. Obviously, the data that I shared earlier about kind of market share and the percentage of American adults that have this is pretty harrowing. One thing that I think is important to keep in mind here, and I imagine this will be one of the things that Jennifer, I would suspect, might take issue with, but my reading of, and to the extent that I've kind of delved in on this and read over the actual debates in 96, it was something of a quid pro quo. This is kind of the argument that I've made. It's a similar argument that I think many of 230 reform proponents, folks like Senator Hawley, Senator Cruz, have made as well. You know, we're all lawyers here, so I don't need to kind of reiterate this. But one thing that Congress very neatly does when it passes a statute, of course, is it kind of oftentimes lists its findings. You know, it's kind of like the whereas at the beginning of a contract, kind of telling us, similar to kind of the Constitution's preamble, what it is that you're trying to do here. So I think it's important to note that, so it's 47 U.S. Code Section 230, subsection A3. This is within the findings provision. Congress is kind of telling us right here among the reasons that they're enacting this statute. And it says here, quote, "The internet and other interactive computer services offer a," here's the key phrase, "offer a forum for a true diversity of political discourse, unique opportunities for cultural development, and myriad avenues for intellectual activity." So put another way here, the Section 230 immunity, I think no matter how you break it down, was at least to some extent, we can kind of debate the extent to which this was true, at least to some extent, it seems like it was predicated upon this notion that the companies that were bestowed these immunity carve-outs would kind of do their best to uphold those paradigms. Now, the issue, of course, is what happens when big tech, for lack of a better term, does not uphold its end of the quid pro quo bargain. And I kind of think to what my friend Eugene Kantarovich, the constitutional law scholar, adjunct, whatever his technical title is, at George Mason University's Antonin Scalia School of Law, he testified in an April 2019 Senate Judiciary Committee hearing on Section 230. And what Eugene said is, he said, quote, "In enacting the immunity provisions, Congress assumed that protected internet services provide, quote, a forum for true diversity of political discourse. To the extent that assumption is weakened by online companies filtering out viewpoints that they deem ideologically impermissible, the assumptions behind Section 230 may need to be revisited." This is a very similar kind of line of argumentation that you know, my friend Rachel Bovard makes, a lot of kind of us in the reform or potentially outright repeal and build from scratch crowd on 230 kind of adhere to. That's the basic argument. I feel like I'm kind of rambling, and we want to get to some more like specific questions, honestly. But that's kind of, I guess, the higher level overview as to how I view this right now.
And Jennifer?
Great, thank you. And I want to echo Josh by thanking Tom for moderating this panel, especially given his own expertise on the topic, as well as to thank the DC Young Lawyers chapter for organizing what I think is going to be a really informative panel and a very timely topic. So I'm going to kind of outline my position. I probably will respond to a couple of things that Josh mentioned in his opening statement that go along with some points that I was already going to make. But I also think there are points that will more likely come up more in the question and answer session and that we have following our opening statements. Section 230 has been critical in allowing an explosion of user-generated content online. And much of the content that we enjoy online these days is user-generated content, whether it's going to YouTube to learn a new skill, going to Yelp to find reviews of new restaurants, or even things we might not typically think of, like the comments section on a blog post, or the comment section on a newspaper article, or things like Wikipedia. All of those are examples of user-generated content that Section 230 says, at its foundational core, the user that created the content is liable for, not the platform or the interactive computer service that is hosting it. It also says that we recognize that these interactive computer services are going to have different audiences that they are trying to serve and therefore may need to engage in different content moderation strategies. We certainly can imagine that different content moderation strategies would serve different audiences, as well as different types of platforms. The type of content moderation that works for Wikipedia might not work for Facebook or Twitter. What we really need to discuss when we're discussing Section 230, though, are these underlying principles and what Section 230 actually does, and not necessarily any one specific decision that we may or may not disagree with. It's perfectly possible to disagree with a private platform's decision, but still think that Section 230 at its core is the best law for the internet, particularly when we're talking about content moderation at scale and these large platforms. Many of us are going to have decisions that we disagree with on both sides of the aisle. This isn't just a case of conservatives or liberals. We certainly see people on all sides feeling that a certain decision wasn't necessarily the right decision. Secondly, I want to point out that Section 230 is not necessarily the special privilege to tech companies that it's sometimes made out to be. Brent Skorup and I wrote a paper at Mercatus about how there actually are common law traditions that would yield towards a more Section 230-like proposal. If we look at how we've treated libraries and bookstores, there certainly is a tradition when we're talking about those who are hosting someone else's speech as of limiting the liability there. And in fact, we're lucky to know what the drafters of Section 230 were thinking. One of the things that Josh alluded to was how oftentimes we want to know what a law's intentions were. And the drafters of Section 230, Representative Cox and now Senator Wyden, have been very clear on what their intentions of Section 230 were, particularly when it comes to some of the misunderstandings around concepts like neutrality. As I mentioned before, while we often have this debate around issues such as Twitter and Facebook, we really need to think about Section 230's impact on the internet as a whole, and not just social media. This is because Section 230 is particularly key for small players and for new players to emerge. It keeps the barriers to entry low because new platforms don't have to worry that someone may abuse their service in a way they never intended, and they find themselves subject to industry-crushing liability. It also means that those platforms can feel more comfortable hosting user-generated content or in going and gaining investors without, again, worrying that they might find themselves subject to litigation for what someone used their service for that they never intended it to be used for. It also means that if a lawsuit were to happen, even if those platforms were later vindicated in court, they wouldn't necessarily find themselves having to undergo the immense costs that are associated with different phases of the litigation. So it's important to know that in a world without Section 230, even a case that was later found to be meritless still is incredibly costly and burdensome, particularly for those small players. And in fact, as a result, that may mean that that a world without Section 230 further entrenches the large players that oftentimes Section 230's critics are the most critical of. Those players would be better able to absorb the additional costs associated with litigation. However, in a world without Section 230, we would likely see platforms return to the problem of what's called the moderator's dilemma. In this world, platforms face two different choices. They either kind of throw up their hands and say, we aren't going to engage in any moderation at all, and hope that that saves them from their liability. Or in the alternative, they engage in very, very heavy-handed moderation. The result there is that users lose out on the benefits of user-generated content and emerging and a greater access to speech. Now, another thing we often hear are questions about, is Twitter or is Facebook the new public square? And I think it's important to note that these arguments have been rejected by the courts so far. These are still private platforms. And why that matters is oftentimes many of the proposals to reform Section 230 would insert more government intervention into speech, particularly when it comes to when we're talking about these already private actors. The result is that could raise serious First Amendment concerns, and not only in the online space, but also raise questions for other areas of what this might lead to in the future. I also want to mention antitrust, because I actually really do disagree with Josh on this idea that content moderation should be thought of in the antitrust context. And in fact, I would argue for extreme caution in seeing content moderation or Section 230 as an antitrust issue. I think this would open up the potential for antitrust to be abused as a political tool and move away from the objective standard and the consumer welfare standard that has served as such a great win of jurisprudence when it comes to enshrining the free market. So as we're examining Section 230, I think it is important, while we can't completely separate the issue from our current large tech companies that are huge successes, I do think it's important to take that step back and examine it on a first principles approach, to examine the impact it has in enabling users who might not have had an ability to have their voices heard when in a pre-internet era, in a more analog era, the opportunity to get their ideas out there, the opportunity to connect with others who they might be able to solve problems with. And as well as its ability to promote innovation and more options for both users and for better services online. And I would caution that changes to Section 230 often involve more government intervention into speech rather than the existing role of Section 230 that allows users to choose what platforms best serve their needs when it comes to speech.
Well, that was a great introduction. Thanks to both of you. I guess my first question to you both would be kind of seeing sort of how far apart you are on this. I'd be curious to know whether, I guess, Jennifer, on one hand, are there any changes you would make to Section 230 as currently constituted? Any sort of arguments of the critics that you think are well-founded and could be addressed through legislative change? And then I guess, Josh, on the other hand, is there some core of Section 230 that you would preserve? And I know that, I guess, to some extent, this might be informed by what alternative remedies the two of you might think are either available or appropriate, and I do want to get into that. But I thought it might be interesting to hear from both of you sort of exactly what you would do with the statute.
Should I go first? Or?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, sure. So I was actually talking earlier today with someone from Facebook's public policy team. It was an off-the-record conversation, so I can't like share names or anything. But we actually had this literal conversation, actually. Now, look, Capitol Hill lawyers are kind of infamously reticent. They're all kind of like infamously reluctant to try to craft creative lawyerly provisions in statutes such that various parties affected, in this case, they would be private corporations, would be kind of treated differently based on kind of metrics like market cap, like market share, things of that nature. But that is more or less along the lines. And I'm kind of implicitly responding to my good friend Josh Craddock's question, which I see in the Q&A here. Josh is asking basically what would happen if we just outright repeal 230, wouldn't that kind of disproportionately help the entrenched interest groups? The short answer is yes. And I was actually really pleased to hear that this gentleman that I connected with at Facebook kind of actually understood and intuited and shared that concern. He kind of basically said that it's true, that we would have to kind of put in its place, whether it's a reform, whether it kind of takes the positivist form of an outright repeal and kind of building its place, we would have to basically try to distinguish. And these are not easy things to do. But I would support some sort of kind of multi-level, two-layer, if you will, provision that would effectively immunize much more conduct from kind of the upstarts, trying to incentivize more competition. I don't know that I don't think I'm conflating 230 and antitrust, like Jennifer says. These are very different legal tools. Personally, I actually support even more draconian remedies. I'm much kind of like the SAS Michael Lind. I'm actually very open to common carrier regulation, frankly. I think actually, given the scope of the problem we're facing, I actually think Section 230 is kind of small potatoes, small ball, to be totally honest with you. What would emerge from the ashes of 230 if we reformed it or burned it down would be something that would try legally, statutorily to protect and incentivize innovation in the upstarts while trying to bring to heel or at least rein in the excessive power of the entrenched interests that do have serious power right now. And you know, one thing that comes to mind. Look, Jennifer is right that the courts, I think, have largely kind of rejected from a black letter legal perspective, this notion, Marsh versus Alabama style, that we have truly outsourced the public square. I make that more as a political argument than a black letter legal argument. But I do think the black letter legal argument is going to continue to percolate. And ultimately, I think we will see more action in the courts here. You know, there was a really, really, really interesting and provocative and I thought quite clever op-ed in the Wall Street Journal in January from Vivek Ramaswamy and Jed Rubenfeld of Yale Law School. And in that article, the authors, they quote a Supreme Court decision, Norwood versus Harrison from 1973, where the court said that it is, quote, axiomatic that the government, quote, may not induce, encourage, or promote private persons to accomplish what it itself is constitutionally forbidden to accomplish. So in terms of kind of censoring constitutionally protected speech here, that is effectively what Section 230, as we as a society have interpreted to be, has permitted. That interpretation could be wrong. Philip Hamburger wrote an essay basically more or less saying that, also in the Wall Street Journal in January. But that is effectively what the status quo is right now. But I'm kind of now getting a little off topic. So Tom, I hope I answered your question.
Well, and I will jump in and answer the other half of the question. And Josh, I apologize if I misheard your opening statement, because I did think I heard you say content moderation was an antitrust issue. And I think you can understand there are significant concerns there that many people have, other myself included, have expressed. In terms of what, if any, changes I think should be made to Section 230, I think it's important to distinguish between legal changes and best practices. So I am always cautious of changing this legal framework because of how quickly it gets abuts the First Amendment, that in many of the cases, many of the proposed changes we're going to see are going to have these First Amendment concerns with them. The other reason I am typically skeptical of many of the changes that are proposed is the fact that it's difficult to iterate every bad thing that could happen. So one of the things we've seen discussed a lot is, you know, is otherwise objectionable too broad of a catch-all? But the problem there is if you just try and list all the bad things that could happen, you're going to miss some, or you're going to end up miscategorizing things that people might want allowed in a healthy debate as something that can't be moderated for. Also, I look at the example of SESTA FOSTA, which I think was very well intentioned to address the harms of sex trafficking and the unintended consequences that law has had, you know, things like Craigslist feeling that they had to take down their personal section, some legitimate speech being removed as a result. And so I'm very cautious of this carve-out approach, particularly in the impact that it could have on smaller platforms who then have different kind of frameworks for different kind of problematic content that may pop up. That being said, I do think, you know, where there is potential conversation to be had are on areas where there is very agreed upon general harm occurring. So we've seen this with the fact that we already have a carve out for federal criminal law. You know, are there more specific things that need to be carved out from there? I think those conversations may happen. But again, I really caution against this carve out approach too much, both because when we're talking about some of the broader categories that get thrown around, it's very easy to see how this could end up not being something that is as commonly agreed upon as a harmful content, or end up silencing legitimate conversations as well. So for example, we heard previously some calls for, do we need a SESTA-FOSTA style regulation for opioids and opioid sales? But there's concerns that having seen what we've seen with FOSTA and SESTA, that you could silence legitimate conversations around people looking for addiction help or people who are struggling with pain management that have legitimate needs for these conversations. So I think that, you know, really looking to best practices and encouraging best practices kind of through self-regulation as opposed to changes to Section 230 is going to be the better solution.
Oh, that was very helpful and interesting. So I will sort of jump on something that Josh said. He used the C word in there, common carrier. And so I know a little bit about that, having argued the net neutrality repeal as FCC General Counsel, which we successfully argued that, you know, it was within our discretion not to classify the internet service providers as common carriers. And part of that was sort of the lack of evidence out there that these companies were in any way abusing their position or in any way sort of blocking or throttling content or data. But I mean, let me sort of, I guess maybe for the audience, if you're not aware, I mean, treating a company like a common carrier, like a railroad, like the traditional telephone company, could involve something like, you know, a non-discrimination mandate so that companies would have less control as to who they could exclude from their services. And I want to sort of give a little history maybe and have both of you react to it in terms of what we might think is the ideal kind of regulatory landscape for ensuring that kind of diverse voices and particularly unpopular conservative voices can be heard in kind of the social media marketplace. So on one hand, you know, we just had the death of Rush Limbaugh, conservative talk radio icon, and you know, kind of a traditional part of the story of the growth of conservative talk radio was that the FCC repealed the Fairness Doctrine. It's a relatively deregulatory environment, allowed many more of the Limbaughs of the world to flourish and to have a voice. You know, at the same time, the FCC maintains a role in allocating a sparse broadcast spectrum. And one question I have is social media different in some way? Is a relatively deregulatory environment the best way to ensure that conservatives and others continue to get platformed? Or is it a problem, for example, if a new entrant to the market can't get hosted or can't get its product to consumers? Is it a problem if all of the major platforms decide we're excluding politician X or social media celebrity Y? Is there a point at which the government needs to put some guardrails around the process to ensure that these points of view are getting to the public? So I guess I'll start with Jennifer this time and hear what both of you think about that.
The common carrier question is one that does seem to have really come up again recently, in part due to a couple of essays that Josh mentioned earlier. I think that there are a couple of concerns when it comes to potentially regulating social media as common carriers. First off, you don't really see the elements that you would see to lead one to declare something a common carrier. This is not something that has a very high cost of entry, that requires a great deal of infrastructure to develop, where having kind of the privilege that comes with declaring something a utility or a common carrier might be beneficial. Additionally, I know a lot of us really love our social media, and I've talked about how beneficial user-generated content is, but it is something we can live without. It is something that people actively choose to not have in their lives at times for various reasons. And so it's very different than kind of what we have traditionally seen as common carriers. I know that this question has continued to evolve, not just with social media, but the question of, as we get further down the internet stack. So there may be some agreement that, you know, Twitter and Facebook are not common carriers, but a question of, when we get to that web hosting level, when we get to the domain registrar level, is there a point where this becomes the tipping point? And I think, again, that my general take has been no, in part because it's a much more complicated and dynamic market, and there are still multiple choices out there. Is there a difference between a web host and a social media platform? I think probably yes. But do I think that this is a cause for common carrier regulation? Again, I don't think we're still seeing those traditional elements met. I would also caution that many of us have found that the repeal of net neutrality, the Restoring Internet Freedom Order that you brought up, that removed these onerous regulations from ISPs, has been incredibly beneficial to innovation, or at least did not break the internet the way that critics of this proposal argued. I think when we're talking about potentially imposing common carrier regulations on a part of the internet, we both have to ask, would that change the legal precedent that is upholding that decision, as well as what would that mean for the dynamics within this market and the innovation within this market? Would granting government granted privilege, again, lock in incumbents, mean that we aren't getting that better option, that we aren't really getting the benefits to consumers of competition that we have in the current dynamic market?
So great question, obviously. If I can just very quickly respond to, I guess, now it was two comments ago from Jennifer, and then I'll kind of pop into Tom's question. So I think what Jennifer said, she made what I think is kind of one of the best arguments against repealing or even severely moderating Section 230. It's actually an argument that my former boss, the Daily Wire, Ben Shapiro, at least used to make. I honestly have not kept up with his commentary on this issue, but at least when I worked for him, he made this exact same argument, which is that, you know, it's so-called moderator's dilemma, and that Section 230 would actually lead to like mass wholesale crackdowns. I don't discount that as a possibility, actually. It seems to me foreseeable that that might happen. I don't necessarily know that it would, but it definitely is possible. I guess my reaction to that is that that clearly would be an instance of effectively a market failure, right? Where these services would not be able to or not acting in accordance with what consumers want, and supply and demand are off balance. So the question then becomes, from the policymaker's perspective, how can we kind of incentivize small startup companies to actually then kind of actually allow for a flourishing marketplace of ideas? That's kind of where we get back to what I mentioned earlier about kind of like a two-pronged, multi-layered 230 immunization statutory scheme. You might even be able to go even a little more aggressive than that if you want to get really creative here, actually. There's a lot of kind of intellectual energy in some quarters of the right these days, kind of like American Affairs Journal, Orrin Cass American Comms Group. So a lot of kind of like newfound energy for kind of a Hamiltonian, Henry Clay, Abraham Lincoln style kind of an industrial policy. You might be able to even think about whether or not the U.S. is kind of like a national interest that might kind of get to an industrial policy, a concerted government effort. Part of this is kind of probably just getting into a bit of a normative disagreement about whether or not government is going to be here, there, and everywhere, kind of counterproductive, whether or not it can ever be productive, which is fine. Anyway, I kind of wanted just to briefly touch on that. Tom, to your question about a fairness doctrine, 230, et cetera, Rush Limbaugh. Look, as I have speaking personally here, as I've kind of gotten older, I've noticed that I care just me personally. I care less and less over the years about quote unquote ideology and kind of abstract principles, and more about kind of the tangential, kind of evidentiary based, kind of here and now. And I thought you kind of teased that very well in your question. Actually, you were talking about kind of the kind of evidentiary look that kind of went at the net neutrality decision with Chairman Pai, and how you didn't see evidence of ISPs discriminating, for example. I mean, that could not be more different, of course, than what we're seeing across some of these companies now. But what we're seeing with Amazon, Twitter, maybe Facebook to a slightly lesser extent, Google obviously cannot be divorced from this discussion at all. So I think the situations on the ground are just very, very different. And the other thing I'll add here, you know, look, I'm not a proponent of big government. I thought when these kind of big tech overreaches, these excesses started to kind of emerge. I'm thinking back to, oh gosh, what was his name? James Damore. We remember him, kind of the conservative Google programmer back in 2017, I think that was. When we first started to see some of kind of the early kind of signs of what was kind of going on inside some of these companies, my reaction, like many of those of my fellow conservatives, was, you know, quote unquote, build your own Google, right? Deregulate, get venture capital. Here's the issue. I think whatever clout, whatever kind of intellectual heft that argument had, died the day that Amazon, Apple, and Google collectively colluded to effectively nuke Parler from existence. That argument, from my perspective, died in January, just 2 months ago. Now, that doesn't mean that there is zero role to play for kind of conservative financiers, conservative entrepreneurs to try to like build their own tech platforms from their garage. But such entrepreneurial, innovative, VC-funded effort, I think necessarily at this point, post-Parler, has to be complemented with some sort of legal reform. Again, we can discuss what that looks like, whether it's 230, antitrust, common carrier, whatever. But there has to be something here because I don't think, quote unquote, build your own Google at this point is sufficient.
Can I respond to this, Tom? So a couple of things to discuss, both in the how difficult is this. One thing to point out is that former President Trump is supposedly building his own social networking system right now. So those who are clamoring for a conservative alternative that they feel for the opinions that are being silenced, there's a possibility that to Josh's point of conservative financiers or whatever, that we may soon see another option emerge. When it comes to Parler, I think that there's an interesting, I don't think that the way Josh framed the story is the same way that I would frame the story, at least, in that you don't necessarily have collusion amongst platforms to silence a competitor. You have platforms that are facing very similar demands from their consumers at the same time, and that they also oftentimes have very similar terms of service. So it can quite likely be a coincidence, not some sort of formal top-down collusion amongst big tech. And similarly, with these claims of anti-conservative bias, when you dig deeper on them, that is not to say that there are not times when conservative content has been blocked or deleted or banned or whatever term you want to use, but there's also same type of anecdotes and examples of content on the left being blocked as well, whether it's Facebook throttling traffic away from Mother Jones or Black Lives Matter activists who feel that their content has been wrongly deleted, that this kind of back and forth happens on both sides of the political spectrum. And again, the data just hasn't really proven out to support this idea that the current large platforms are completely biased against conservatives, when in fact some of the most widely shared posts are often by conservative authors, particularly when it comes to Facebook.
Jess, you want to say a word, or you?
Whatever you want, Tom. I mean, so look, it obviously is true. I mean, again, my former boss Ben Shapiro is a good example of this. Obviously, you know, his personal page, the Daily Wire, they do extraordinarily well on the Facebook metrics. I don't have, it's very hard to kind of quantify some of this stuff. Obviously, it's very hard to kind of have like actual statistical metrics for what kind of user on Twitter, for example, is quote unquote right of center, what kind of user is left of center. I have a million anecdotes, obviously. I don't want to kind of like bog down our time with anecdotes. But look, you know, this is what I said kind of off the record to this Facebook I was talking with earlier today, because I actually do have less of an issue with Facebook. My concerns with Facebook actually kind of come more from an antitrust perspective and previous decisions with respect to WhatsApp and Instagram, for example. But Facebook's content moderation policies actually do seem to me, they're not ideal, but they do seem to me to be kind of orders of magnitude better than Twitter's, for example. And look, I'm kind of a simple guy. You know, my friend Mike Davis from the Internet Accountability Project would probably tell me that my politics are quote unquote caveman. I basically want to do good to my friends and do bad to my enemies. And, you know, I look as a very simple-minded political guy. I look at someone like Jack Dorsey, this guy who shows up to these hearings with who looks like a freaking caveman, who was donating tens of million dollars to fund Ibram X. Kendi and his anti-racism, insidious garbage. And I identify him as someone who is probably not looking out for my best interest. Now, these companies can help if they want to be transparent, if they want to kind of produce content moderation stuff. I don't think Twitter came anywhere close to meaning that in the aftermath of kind of the New York Post Hunter Biden thing, for example. Again, I think Facebook does do a slightly better job. It's not ideal, but they have this kind of 20-member oversight board now. They are doing a better job overall.
Yeah, thanks. I want to touch on something that both of you kind of mentioned and your answers have mentioned a number of times, this possibility of collusion, whether it's happening, this potential remedy of antitrust. And so I'd be curious in hearing from both of you, maybe sort of what do you sort of kind of view the ground rules of as we talk about applying antitrust to social media? I mean, how would you, for example, define the market? Is it a product market? If so, what is it? Is it all social media companies? Does each company occupy its own market somehow? What harm should we be looking at? Is it the traditional consumer welfare standard, or is it time to jettison that in favor of something else? And really, what is the end game? What is sort of the outcome that we ought to be looking for? Is it more competition? Is it better quality services? So that's a lot, but I think sometimes we just hear about applying antitrust without kind of thinking about some of these first principles. So I'd kind of love to hear from both of you what you think. Maybe why don't we stick with you, Josh, since Jennifer started last time.
Sure. Yeah. So I mean, look, I am not advocating a jettisoning, hard word to say, to jettison the consumer welfare standard in antitrust law. What I do think, and this is something that my friend who I mentioned earlier, Rachel Bovard, Rachel's written on this, quite compellingly. I do think that kind of antitrust legal scholars over the years have gotten kind of over infatuated with the notion that the consumer welfare standard, you know, Bob Bork's antitrust paradox, et cetera, kind of boils down to the notion that it's all about price, that price is the only thing that matters. It seems to me that if we truly kind of care about maximizing consumer welfare, which again, I do agree, I'm not necessarily trying to change that fundamental paradigm, there are other things that we should care about. Sheer choice, I think choice of platform should be something to at least consider here. I think consumer welfare probably is better maximized when we consider things outside of price and talk about we are just free to choose from a competing number of providers. So when a search engine like Google has 90%+ market share, whatever it is in an online search, whether price concerns aside, that ought to be kind of viewed, I think, as kind of ipso facto problematic. Now, I guess to kind of get back to what we were talking about a little bit with Jennifer earlier, here's where I guess actually the content moderation and the antitrust do intersect a little bit. They are largely distinct issues. But when you have a market share hegemon, that is not engaging in good faith, that does not have a transparent kind of a quote-unquote neutral or even kind of readily discernible content moderation policies, I do think that kind of necessarily kind of escalates the imperative to kind of come in with some sort of other remedy. It's not necessarily antitrust. Again, it could be something a little more outside the box. But look, I think the tide on this is changing. I mean, after my first year of law school summer, I was a Senate Judiciary Committee law clerk for Mike Lee, Senator from Utah, of course. And at that time, he was ranking member on the antitrust subcommittee. And, you know, back when I interned for Senator Lee, it wasn't obvious to me you know, that Mike would ever see a merger that he necessarily thought should be kind of held up on kind of like classic, like classical liberal kind of, pro private sector grounds, lack of a better term. But, you know, he had a statement a week and a half, 2 weeks ago on big tech and consumer welfare standards, very lengthy statement. I would love to meet whoever wrote it. It was quite wonderful, actually. And he was kind of breathing fire on this issue. And again, he's citing Bork, his paradigmatic work. He's not trying to change consumer welfare standard, nor for that matter, are even kind of quote unquote radicals, right? People like Ken Buck, who's kind of like on the, you know, he's kind of the tip of the spear on conservative angst on antitrust right now. To best my knowledge, Congressman Buck is not trying to change the consumer welfare standard either. Rather, the approach is trying to take kind of a more kind of wholesome, kind of full spectrum approach to what maximizing consumer welfare actually means. That is not just price minimization.
I think Josh and I are actually going to agree a little bit on some things here, in that I do agree that I think the consumer welfare standard remains the critical element when it comes to antitrust. I also think that it is a standard that can meet the demands of today's tech industry. I think that we've seen in both the antitrust modernization report, as well as with the way that it's been applied in other cases, that it can apply to a growing and dynamic industry. I also think that, you know, we oftentimes do only focus on price, but there is a lot of very excellently argued research out there about how the consumer welfare standard can encompass more than just price while remaining an objective standard. I also will say I thought it was very good to hear Representative Buck in one of the hearings recently mention that he did advocate for upholding the consumer welfare standard. And we've seen again Senator Lee's leadership on this issue in the Senate as well. Where we probably disagree is when it comes to whether or not consumer harm is currently occurring, as well as what the definition potentially of these markets are. And I would point out that, you know, if we were having this conversation a decade, 15, 20 years ago, we'd be arguing about whether MySpace is a natural monopoly and whether Yahoo had won the search wars and what we were going to do about the AOL Instant Messenger merger with ICQ, and so on and so forth. And what we've seen is that oftentimes we have dramatic changes in technology that we can't predict that very much change how we even view these markets, that these continue to be innovative and dynamic markets where not only are large players competing with each other, but where new entrants are emerging as well, where you have something like TikTok or Clubhouse that may completely change the way that we view social media in the future and are rapidly gaining popularity. That being said, you know, I'm not going to use my own crystal ball and say that there could never be an antitrust argument against a tech platform, but just based off of what is publicly known so far, we aren't seeing the behavior of monopolists. We're seeing platforms that continually have to improve to keep up with consumer demands, that are continually competing not only with one another, but also with smaller players, and continue to have an incredibly dynamic industry, both at the kind of high level of these large players, as well as at the startup level, and not just in the sense of startups that then get acquired by these larger companies, which can benefit consumers, but also with new ideas that are completely dramatic and different and may change the way that we all are able to communicate or otherwise connect or pursue a good or service.
I'm just really curious here. Is Google not a monopolist? I mean, if I'm mistaken, it's like 50 state AGs are suing Google on antitrust grounds. Is Google really not a monopolist in any respect?
I would say Google is not a monopolist. I mean, one can, even in search, one can easily think of Bing, which is owned by Microsoft, which is not exactly a small player and is a default on several devices as a competitor in the search market, as well as those that serve particular markets such as DuckDuckGo for the more privacy sensitive.
Okay.
Well, I also want to say there was a great Wall Street Journal article in the last year about how during the pandemic, more people are starting to use ICQ as kind of a retro nostalgic thing. So it's coming back, even though I think AOL Instant Messenger is dead. But I mean, a lot of the back and forth, I mean, we've talked about how kind of facts on the ground with technology have changed over the years. And one thing I would love to get both of your views on is another kind of a prominent figure who argued that facts on the ground have changed over time. And that was Judge Silberman, who had this sort of explosive dissent in a libel case that came up before the DC Circuit. And that kind of touches on some of the issues of big tech and media that we've been talking about today. So basically this case was called TA, if I'm saying that right, the Global Witness. Actual issue in the case was whether this particular complaint had adequately pleaded a case for libel against a public figure. And that was under the Supreme Court's decision in New York Times versus Sullivan. The applicable standard was very high, difficult to meet, was is actual malice. You need to show that actual malice was involved. And so the principal kind of back and forth between Judge Tatel, who wrote the majority, and Judge Silberman's dissent was on whether actual malice had been adequately pleaded on the facts of this case. But at the end of his dissent, Judge Silberman goes on to say that he would recommend that the Supreme Court jettison the actual malice standard altogether. And if I could characterize his argument, you can both tell me if you disagree, but as I sort of read it, it seems like what he was saying was, look, he didn't believe actual malice had any basis in the text or original meaning of the Constitution, and that the Supreme Court had adopted it for policy reasons. And basically that policy reason was, they hope by making it harder for plaintiffs to show libel, that it would actually lead to sort of a freer and open, more open press. And at the time, sort of what the facts that the court were dealing with when it decided that case were that a lot of people were using libel, weaponizing libel to prevent coverage of Jim Crow and the civil rights movement. And so those were sort of the predicate facts that the court was dealing with when it adopted that standard. But Silberman goes on to say that he believes that today things have not played out how the court thought they would, that we don't have a freer and more diverse press. What we have is a relatively monolithic left-leaning press, with some notable examples, but he said by and large, these predictions that the court was making about the what its heightened standard would do have not come to fruition. So it might be time to jettison that standard entirely and return to a more plaintiff-friendly common law standard of libel. So Jennifer, I thought we'd start with you. I mean, I know that you and others have argued, like under Section 230, a lot of these cases that people would bring, even if you didn't have it, would get dismissed on First Amendment grounds anyway, or would get dismissed because of kind of heightened standards. So Judge Silberman seems to think, let's rethink the First Amendment itself. So good idea, terrible idea. What do you both think about that?
So I'm going to start off by clarifying an answer I gave to Josh's last question. And I am going to clarify that I do not think that the current facts have fully proven that Google would be considered a monopolist. I think there are competitors that can be named. That being said, I will be watching the court case like all of us to see what the court says when it comes to some of these facts you and I are debating. And so maybe we'll have to have a follow-up antitrust panel as some of these cases progress. That being said, when it comes to this question of particularly New York Times versus Sullivan and the First Amendment in general, I do think we are having some conversations that were some of the criticism of Section 230, some of the criticism of these decisions are criticisms of the way the First Amendment is being applied. I do think in a world without Section 230, it would be interesting to see how Sullivan was to get applied, particularly in this question of when is someone a public figure, particularly in a limited capacity in the kind of current social media world. So I will say, I think that is another element of the Section 230 reform or repeal debate that we don't necessarily have as much, that maybe is a place that we should be having more, particularly academic conversations about what does this mean for these other precedents in a world where we no longer would have the legal certainty that, or when we're waiting for courts to emerge with a standard for when platforms or other online services are going to be held liable for users' content?
So I like so many others, I read Judge Silberman's dissent, and I was grinning ear to ear the whole time. Or at least section three, when he kind of got into the more normative kind of less kind of case specific questions. It was just fabulous to see. The rhetoric was, if you're anything other than a conservative, I'm sure you'd be appalled by the rhetoric referring to the Times and the Post as quote Democratic Party broadsheets or whatever the term he used was. Look, New York Times versus Sullivan, from my perspective, it was wrong the day it was decided. It's still wrong. Justice Scalia, to his credit, criticized it over and over and over again. Justice Thomas and kind of his concurrence, I believe the posture was his concurrence from the denial of cert in 2019 Cosby case, McKee versus Cosby, called for Sullivan to be overturned. I actually was candidly disappointed that Justice Alito did not join that. He probably agrees, just didn't want to go out on a limb. It's a procedural matter. Look, this notion that defamation law really should be kind of cabined, frankly, at all by the First Amendment would have been wholly anathema to the founders. I think this is just a total slam dunk of an originalist issue. I mean, there were prosecutions, for blasphemy well into the 19th century. The common law of defamation was exceedingly robust. It remained robust for 150 plus years after the American founding. And even if you don't want to fully pare back New York Times or Sullivan, there was also kind of case law that built up shortly after the Sullivan case came down. Initially, of course, the case was solely about a public official, and then the kind of case law kind of extended the public official nomenclature to public figures. Then we got from public figures to limited purpose public figures. It's a whole mess. I remember this from my first year brief at University of Chicago Law School, which, if I recall correctly, was on defamation law. So it was on all these cases, actually. So Sullivan is a total mess. I say that, by the way, as the opinion editor of Newsweek. I guess my pure cynical self-interest would be against overturning New York Times versus Sullivan. But to get back to kind of my quote-unquote my self-anointed caveman politics about kind of rewarding one's friends and punishing one's enemies within the confines of the rule of law, the mainstream media, I say this as a member of the mainstream media, the mainstream media is by and large our enemy within kind of that dichotomous juxtaposition, that paradigm. And the bare minimum that we can do is overturn an effectively lawless decision and hold them liable under traditional law of defamation.
All right. Well, I think what I'd like to do is we got a couple questions here from the attendees. So why don't we try to get through those, and then I'll let you guys briefly sum up. So the first one is interesting, is we have been talking a lot about 230C1, but there is this second part of Section 230C2, which essentially says, I don't have it in front of me, but essentially says, interactive computer services, shall not be held liable for decisions they make to kind of delete content, which is, and this is in the question now, quote, obscene, lewd, lascivious, filthy, excessively violent, harassing, or otherwise objectionable. So is there some argument that, and there's a huge debate, right, over how this liability shield sort of relates to the earlier 230C1 that we have just been talking about. I think a lot, because it's just a lot easier, a lot of companies just rely on C1 immunity. A lot of the case law deals with C1 immunity, doesn't get into this. But I guess I'll just open it up for you to respond however you'd like. I mean, is there any room for sort of saying, look, you've got free rein in trying to get rid of the kind of stuff that the Good Samaritan provision was designed to allow you to get rid of, but you can't venture into other territory. You can't use it as a form of private censorship, essentially. And certainly, as I've sort of been grappling with the policy issues, a challenging question for me going down this road is, who decides that, right? I mean, Josh mentioned that, Facebook has, created kind of a moderation or kind of board of appeals. I know some of the, some of the legislative proposals have suggested that either the FTC or some new government agency make these sorts of calls. So have both of you react to that? And I guess it's, yeah. I think it's Josh's turn.
Yeah, right? Jonah, I think your question is kind of going along the right path here. I guess I'm a little unclear under existing case law interpreting C1, how much legwork this would do, but it kind of gets me to a related thought, which is my friends at the American Principles Project, Terry Schilling and John Schweppe, have been very outspoken on the 230 platform access issue. I kind of was chatting about it today, actually, with that Facebook guy that I've mentioned like three or four, whatever times now. One thing that my friends at APP have kind of proposed in some form or another is the form can be whatever it is. It can be a statutory a reform of Section 230, can be a new statute, would effectively be kind of a statutory right of action to basically say on statutory law that your content could not be deleted, if it were to be legal, if the same material were kind of shouted from the sidewalk or said in the old Thomas Paine town square. In a sense here, that seems to be kind of right along the lines of that quote from a Supreme Court decision from 1973 that I read, way earlier about how the government cannot, the court said it is, quote, axiomatic. It is self-evident that you cannot kind of deputize private actors to censor that which you cannot censor. So that's kind of along the same lines there. I'm not entirely sure if I'm fully answering the question, so just because I'm not entirely sure how this would work, frankly, if C1 were interpreted as it is. Tom, you probably have more expertise on this, frankly, than I do. I'd be curious for Jennifer's comments, too.
So I would push back that this is not shouting from the sidewalk. This is shouting from inside a coffee shop or inside a department store. Does the department store have the right to tell you to at least go out on the sidewalk? I think that distinction is very different. This is not a public property element. This is a private property. And the question of what terms of service, what moderation policies you can set for private property. And I do think that distinction matters a lot when we're talking about platforms' ability to content moderate and how this interacts with different elements of speech. I also think it's important to point out what limiting the ability to moderate could do, not only to kind of these general use platforms, but to platforms that may be serving a more targeted audience, to platforms that may be trying to create a more family-friendly audience, even this could really impinge their ability to have the content moderation practices that they feel are going to best serve their audiences, as well as the ability to, like I said, this kind of question of dictating the rules that private actors are and are not allowed to have when it comes to what speech that they host.
Let me just add one quick thing, Tom. Jonah, if you haven't already done so, I'd recommend that you read that Phil Hamburger essay that I mentioned earlier. It's from the Wall Street Journal in January. It was entitled "The Constitution Can Crack Section 230," because I really do think your question kind of gets to the core of whether the courts have actually authentically interpreted C1, something that Justice Thomas himself recently opined about as well. So that itself is starting to pick up steam.
All right, let's see if we can get to the last two questions in the queue. I guess the second one is just about how objective is this consumer welfare standard? Who decides? In the history of this, right? I mean, at the beginning of the Sherman Act, I mean, there are all sorts of other kind of, political fairness type considerations that came into the hopper. As you say, Josh, a very minimalist way of thinking about this might be price, but doesn't that exclude quality and other things that consumers care about? So how objective is this and how should we think about it? Jennifer, you want to start?
Yeah, I think the consumer welfare standard has done a strong job of really inserting an objective view over those prior interpretations that were often used to determine, on very subjective grounds, where large companies and small companies none of them knew whether or not a certain action would be considered damaging, and this presumption that big is bad merely because it's big. I am very concerned about rhetoric we hear at times that seems to be pushing back to that idea that big is bad just because it is big. I'm also at times concerned about the shift away from the focus on consumers and more back towards competitors as opposed to what the impact is on the market that consumers experience. I do think it's important to note that the consumer welfare standard is not currently statutory. I do think that is one potential antitrust change that could improve things is to codify the consumer welfare standard. When it comes to ensuring that it's not hijacked for these political purposes, I think that is what the advantage of the current approach is, as opposed to kind of the neo-Brandeisian approach that would bring in all of these other concerns, such as fairness or the impact on competitors that was mentioned earlier. And the concern there is, even if you want to do it for something a policy reason that you may feel is important or is just in some way, there's the danger of, would you want your political opponents to have that same powerful tool, that same ability to break companies up and to interfere in the market for their policies that you may disagree with?
Yeah. So, hi, Alexandra. Good to chat with you. I was talking with your husband just earlier today. So good to have your question here. I guess my obvious response is I don't know what the obvious alternative is. Big is bad is the only one that comes immediately to mind. Here's the issue with that. The issue that kind of leaps off the page with that, and to be clear, I think most of the time that probably is just fine. Matt Stoller, of course, it's kind of his perspective. There are any number of kind of reasonable and smart and well-informed people that come to the conclusion that big is bad, and that should be kind of the paradigm of our antitrust approach. But, in law school and economics courses, whatever, you learn about externalities. You learn about both negative and positive externalities, network effects, whatever you want to call them. And, I kind of come back to Facebook, right? I mean, part of the appeal of Facebook, part of the appeal of LinkedIn, to kind of just use another social media platform, is that everyone is on it. I mean, the appeal, the entire kind of business model of something like that is orders of magnitude diminished when you start breaking it up, because the entire purpose is to be friends with your friends and to like see all in one newsfeed what everyone's life updates are, the cute baby photos, whatever, things of that nature, right? So I do think that consumer welfare is probably, just for sheer lack of my ability to kind of conjure up something that I find more intellectually compelling. To Alexander's specific question, is there anything to prevent it from being overtaken by progressive values? I don't really know. I mean, I am a skeptic of antitrust law as it's been enforced in general. I mean, I think back to my antitrust law course in law school, the way judges kind of manipulate this to reach the preferred outcomes is somewhere between disturbing and abhorrent on a fairly routine basis. I was not enamored by the quality of the judicial opinions that I read in that course, if I think back to it. I just don't know what else it could be. And I guess I'm just, humble, or maybe just frankly stupid enough to admit that.
Well, let's do one more and then we'll let you guys close up. This is a good one to end on, since the name of this panel is the future of Section 230. So Evan Bullock writes, given that politicians on both sides of the aisle appear driven to change Section 230, will likely happen whether we want it or not. What sort of features of reform should we be wary of? Are there any lessons to be learned from how Europe is regulating social media? And I guess I'll add my own perspective. I'm actually more of a skeptic that anything might change. I guess first, both just because of general tendency towards congressional inaction. And the second is just because of the way in which the Democratic and Republican approaches to this are kind of diametrically opposed. And I'm oversimplifying here, but I think a lot of Republicans are wary of too much content moderation because they feel like their voices are being stifled on social media. I think progressives are more worried about the stuff that's making it through, whether it be, misinformation, interference in elections, what have you. And so where you have these different approaches, I mean, can you settle on any sort of reasonable reform effort? So I'll add that to the question in the queue. And Josh, why don't you take it?
Yeah, so I'm actually not super bullish, honestly, that some sort of landmark Section 230 reform should happen for a very simple reason. I mean, if you basically look at what both parties are saying, you know, the median Democrat is kind of saying, you know, Putin helped elect Trump, Russiagate, whatever, you know, bots, you're not doing enough to crack down on hate speech, January 6th Capitol riot. And the Republican rhetoric is something closely approximating the complete opposite of that, of course. It's basically saying that, you know, it's censoring too many conservatives. So one side is saying you're not censoring enough. The other, so there is there like a Venn diagram overlap possibility here? I think there is. It's very frustrating, right, for those of us who are kind of skeptical of the status quo, because there is such intense angst on both sides of the political aisle on this issue that it's kind of it kind of feels like the kind of thing that should just fall into place. But I'm actually less optimistic than maybe some others on the right are. I'm not sure that some sort of major thing would happen. If there is reform, what should we be wary of? We kind of discussed this already a little bit, right? This kind of gets back to what Josh Craddock's question was that we discussed earlier about kind of overcorrecting and basically making so that startups, innovators are impossible. That would be what we should be wary of. It would take some sort of clever creative lawyering, as we discussed earlier, to make sure, or at least do our best to make sure that does not happen. But that is definitely the number one thing, I think, to be wary of from a consumer welfare perspective, of course, is kind of, I am kind of blurring the lines, but as from a consumer's perspective, we don't want to unduly disincentivize innovators, entrepreneurs, venture capitalists, et cetera, from getting into the tech space.
To echo what Tom and Josh have already said, I do think that in most cases, the two sides of the aisle have diametrically opposed reasons that they want change. And so as a result, broad scale revoke or repeal does not seem likely. As was mentioned earlier, typically on the left, you have criticism that platforms are not engaged in enough moderation. Typically on the right, there is this the concern comes from an idea that they are engaged in too much moderation. If looking at where we have seen changes to Section 230 in the past with SESTA-FOSTA is any example, if there were to be changes, I think you would see them around these kind of carve-outs, which also means we can look at examples of what impact has that had and what could be done differently to perhaps make it not have the same impact if there were to be additional carve-outs. So that includes thinking about what are the unintended consequences when it comes to what standard is being applied, how narrowly defined is the content in question, things like that. Is this already covered by existing carve-outs to Section 230? And likewise, what would that impact be on not just large platforms and platforms who have quite a bit of scale, but also on smaller platforms and on non-social media platforms as well. The other thing I would suggest looking at as we see continued proposals from both the left and the right when it comes to Section 230 reform is what does this mean for First Amendment rights? What does this mean for the government role in speech, and how is that different, and what concerns might arise with each of these proposals?
That's great. Well, we've got about 10 minutes left, so maybe Jennifer, you could take the first five, and Josh, you can close us out.
Well, I want to once again thank Tom and Josh for what I think was a very nice panel, and to thank everyone for attending. As we've discussed, there is a lot to think about when it comes to online content, but I go back to those first principles of individual users are the ones who make their decisions about what content that they share, and therefore they should be the ones who bear the responsibility for the content that is contained there. That's one of the first elements of Section 230. The second is that we believe that a market that allows different options to meet different user demands is one that can flourish with new innovative ideas, new ways to connect, and new forms of user-generated content that we might not have been able to predict. In general, this has been beneficial to us as users and consumers in the wide range of content we have available to us. No longer are you confined to just what can make your local paper or the three major news networks. You can go online and find various points of views and various first-person accounts of what is actually happening, and hopefully come to your own conclusions about what that means for your own opinions. Additionally, when it comes to Section 230, we have to look not just at its role on the large players, but also on the small players. The fact that this is critically important to new platforms that are trying to emerge, and that it also is part of what has allowed a huge amount of content online. I also want to take a step back, though, and position this debate in the broader kind of conversation around technology in general. I would argue, particularly in 2021 and what many of us have experienced over the last year, that technology is incredibly beneficial. In fact, we wouldn't be having this panel this evening without technology. We've seen the fact that in the past decade, we've had huge leaps, both in technology that involves user-generated content, as well as other technological platforms, and that we as users benefit with that in such a way that we almost forget what our lives were like before. So as we're exploring whether or not technology needs more regulation, I think we also have to take a step back and reflect on the fact that this light touch regulatory approach has yielded an incredible entrepreneurial spirit, and it allowed a hugely dynamic industry to emerge in a way that benefits us as consumers.
So yes, thank you so much to Tom and to Farrell Slade for hosting this. I want to just emphasize something I said at the outset. Tom is just so like experienced and has so much relevant expertise here. I feel almost guilty that he's not a participant in this conversation. But although, of course, he's always welcome to write an op-ed for my Newsweek opinion page on these topics. So I hope I can extend that offer, and I hope that you take me up on it. Look, so I want to start, and I won't take up 5 minutes. I can keep this very quick. I want to echo actually strongly something that Jennifer said, which is we don't want to lose the forest for the trees here. Capitalism, technology, these things, of course, net over net, obviously, improve our lives, make our lives better. I think back to a fascinating and simultaneously utterly hilarious Clubhouse chat that I was in a couple weeks ago. I literally could not stop laughing, actually. A gentleman who's an editor, writer, I can remember at the American Conservative magazine, basically said that we have to do everything possible to get back to the Jeffersonian agrarian society, and we need to basically just gut all technology whatsoever. And he basically said that it should be a pressing public policy priority to eradicate computers whenever possible. And you know, someone from the audience basically, you know, raised his hand and said, you know, like, let's be clear here. You know, we're talking about going back in this pre-technological era to where infant mortality rate was like astronomically higher than it is. I mean, there were real kind of bread and butter quality of life issues. So I'm not saying, to be clear, that applying Section 230 or gutting it or whatever to Facebook would get us back to those days. But obviously, we need to be deeply prudential here, and we need to be cognizant of the general course of history insofar as capitalism, technology, lifting lies. This is a conversation among conservatives. No one here is kind of questioning those, I think, fundamental first principles, or at least I certainly am not. Having said that, I do kind of take back to what I said earlier. I think Jennifer and I just have a bit of a disagreement as to whether or not we truly have kind of privatized the functional equivalent of the public square. That is kind of the overarching, I think, paradigm disagreement here. Again, like we said earlier, we briefly touched on Marsh versus Alabama and how the courts have not yet adopted that as a matter of black letter law. But as a kind of political point to kind of influence how policymakers ought to think about this, I think that is the key point to make here. And I think really kind of all these various policy arguments, 230, antitrust, common carrier, public accommodation under the 64 Civil Rights Act, any of these various tools are necessarily kind of intellectually downstream of perhaps a higher order possible disagreement over whether or not we outsource. One, on the one hand, whether we've outsourced the public square, at least largely speaking, to these unaccountable corporate actors. And two, closely related to that, is whether these unaccountable actors have been acting in good faith in kind of a politically, intellectually, philosophically, et cetera, neutral fashion.
Well, I will avoid any sort of John McLaughlin-esque pronouncement at the end of this, but I will just thank Jennifer and Josh for some incredible insights today. Thank you, the Federalist Society, for hosting this. And I guess we'll need to continue the conversation on Clubhouse if that's what the kids are doing these days. So, Ben, I don't know if you want to say anything, but otherwise, thanks to everyone for tuning in.
No, nothing more from me, but to thank everybody. This has been a fantastic event. And one of the things I love about FedSoc is that we can have people get together to respectfully discuss this in a way that doesn't often happen on the social media platforms we were discussing.
Great. Well, take care, everybody. Have a good night.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.